Yeah, it's amazing that neutrino interactions can never matter, and they don't in physical situation. And they don't, I think, if you were talking about just scattering. It has to be some coherent thing over a shorter time scale than a scattering time scale for them to be. We're thinking about, there's a literature now on speeded up evolution.
Oh, thank you. I told you I'd do it, and I did it.
The application over and over again is this supernova out towards the neutrino sphere, point of last scattering, or beyond. All the people that do this all have their hopes that it'll raise its ugly head in some other place. But here, just a possible... Okay, I can't see anything. Is that because I don't know what I'm doing on the pointer? Oh, there it is. as a possible set of conditions, just thermal... not thermal neutrinos, but a density as though they were thermal with a temperature of 7 MeV or so. And the phenomena that I'm going to be talking about are rapid flavor exchange, number one. The reason we care about that maybe is that the energy spectra are, in people's simulations, quite different with the new and tau neutrinos being harder and the electron neutrinos and antineutrinos being softer. So if you swap flavors keeping the states the same, you build up the potency of what's coming out beyond the neutrino sphere to do stuff like do heating. And it also changes the neutron to proton ratio out there, which probably George Fuller talked about that week before last. So that's the reason in this system for thinking about this stuff. The mechanics of the rapid change that I'll be talking about will be instabilities in the mean field. Well, something I call the mean field. I should say that this whole talk was really stimulated by the fact that Jürgen asked George a week ago Friday, how about corrections beyond the mean field? And George said, well, we haven't worried about that. And that I had spent so much time in the past trying to tell people that they might be important, you know. So I went back and started thinking about it again. Well, I'll have to define what the mean field means, but these are nonlinear equations, so they are capable of having instabilities. And as a bonus, I claim I can say something about beyond the mean field and the comparison of situations in which the mean field is stable with situations in which the mean field is unstable when we go beyond the mean field. Time scales in these problems, as defined by the context earlier. there's a very fast time scale, which is just the Fermi constant times the particle density. It says ENE there, but that was a reflex. That should be the number of neutrinos, really. Neutrino density. And that's a real short, a fraction of a centimeter. And there's a familiar oscillation scale. Mass squared difference divided by energy, and that's the inverse of a distance. If we take solar parameters of 10 kilometers or so, and then in what people calculate, and this is all just experimental computing, but you will go in there and you will detect a time scale which is the square root of these two things. A medium fast time scale, which is a meter or so, and in distance. And in that distance, you know, the electron density isn't changing very much, so we're not going to talk about MSW transitions or anything like that over those distances, although there's been a whole lot of work on it, particularly in the past when people thought that the mass differences were bigger than they're now known to be, on what MSW transformations would do. Oh, and so I've located these references here. The medium fast, well, the recent papers by Raffelt and his collaborators. I think some of what George was talking about is characterized this way, and some of it is actually old MSW and a couple old papers of mine.
There's a field of very fast timescale that should be neutrino density. Is there not a timescale associated with the electron density as well?
The electron density matters a lot, of course, in any kind of MSW sort of mixing thing. It's the neutrino density. Just believe me for a while, that's going to matter here.
So can you tell us what physics cares about that medium fast timescale?
That has to, we have to have the instability first. And then I think it's logical, Larry. I mean, that's why it's kind of fun doing this. Fun doing it. I'm pretty bored with the application, but when I come back and think about what goes into it, I kind of like it. So, neutrino-neutrino interactions, just from the neutral current, just from a W exchange, we can write the part that I want of the interaction Hamiltonian in terms of density operators for modes of the neutrino. It doesn't matter, bosons or fermions. Nothing I do with these quadratic things cares about the statistics. And then I will pick out from the neutral current Hamiltonian, I will pick out something which is, I'll call the forward Hamiltonian. Why should I be doing this? Because, as I said at the beginning, if we go a kilometer, there are going to be scattering effects, and you'll want to scatter from one state to another. But pure index of refraction effect, something where a neutrino sees a potential from other neutrinos and does something in consequence, that is, everybody's assumptions on that, I should say, is built into here. So we took the Hamiltonian and we have written only things where a neutrino of momentum P is absorbed and a neutrino of momentum Q is absorbed in emission. And maybe the flavor changes. It would be nothing except for the possibility that the flavor changed. And I've got these flavor indices I and J. Well, actually, again, one can explore two neutrino models or three flavors of neutrino models. I'm going to explore two. It has become conventional when you do that in this kind of problem. You call the one that isn't the electron neutrino the X. It's some coherent mixture of mu and tau. And all that works pretty well as long as Theta 1-3 is small. So we have a quartic interaction in the Fermi fields here, or a quadratic interaction in these densities, and it's got a density and minus an antiparticle density. What's particularly important here is the angular dependence. Angle dependence will be the key in everything that I have to say. And this last term down here, which has just got the trace in the internal space, that's inactive. These things are all conserved, so we can throw that away at all, altogether. And then these density operators have commutation rules, and we can look at the dynamics from the Heisenberg equation. And there are equations of motion, and which to me, by the way, these guys, the density and the density. I'm calling that a, I'm not calling it a density matrix yet, because I haven't taken, I haven't replaced it by any expectation of the operator in the medium. So this is still an operator product of a row by a row. This is the equation that just follows from that Hamiltonian, except I've added in an oscillation term as well, which I didn't put explicitly over there, which is just a commutator of some matrix with the density as a matrix in IJ space. And now, so we started out with one simplification, which was the forward Hamiltonian. We reduced to those modes going the same direction. I think it's good to think of the mean field approximation as something separate that we have to think about. And that only means that the medium expectation of a product of two rows is the product of the expectations of the individual rows. And I take that in this equation itself, right? Not in the original Hamiltonian. After getting the Heisenberg equation of motion, we make this mean field. And then we have a set of nonlinear equations for density matrix elements, and we can discuss their solutions.
Was it important that you used here non-relativistic description? Or
what?
It was a non-relativistic description. Yeah, you took your densities as a dagger. Is it a matter that you use a non-relativistic?
Yeah. Well, yeah, because these are vector densities, right? So it's psi adjoint psi. It isn't psi bar psi. There's no... It's P into P, so it is just A adjoint P. I mean, there's a there's always a non-relative, no, there's always an expansion in powers of M squared over E when we do the oscillation term. And so the proposal, and this again is following what everybody else does, is to begin with flavor diagonal initial situation, which says that the electron and electron and other kind, XX components of this density matrix are something, and the flavor mixing parts are nothing, because there's not a lot of mixing way under there, and the mixing only comes in later on, and that's for a couple different reasons. The parameters are small, and solve. Parameters are small, and the electron C does make a difference. Oh, and just to satisfy honor that there might be a physical domain, here's an imagined picture of the edge of the neutron star with neutrinos running every which way, and a little region out on the end just under the neutrino sphere, and then neutrinos going away, headed outwards farther uphill. And here is our spectra from simulations, energy spectra, emergent energy spectra as a function of time after the neutrino ball starts, where you see that the mu, and that would be the tau, the mu bar and the tau bar as well, are quite a bit stiffer than the electron and positron.
So how did you really put in this mean field approximation? You took your Hamilton equation.
Yeah, and it was quadratic in the rows as operators, and I just bracketed
all possibilities.
Yes.
Of bracketing and
no, only the possibility that kept a P with a Q, a P with a P, and a Q with a Q. So I didn't say P with a Q and Q with a P, and that will give something. That will give something. That's the interesting part. But yeah, I've got to do this first. So, it's that because the electron neutrinos and energies scatter more than the mu's and the tau's, the energy and angular distributions of the two near the neutrino sphere will be somewhat different. If you get right up here, you should say between the neutrino surfaces of the average last scattering of the mu and the E, then the mu neutrinos, these blue things, will be more predominantly outwards and higher energy than whatever this color this is. What color is that?
Green.
Oh, yeah. That's green is the color I don't see. There should be a warning on the color palette. I mean, I see it, but I don't know what the name of it is. And so, see, there are more blues going up, and they're more energetic, and there are more greens going down, and they're less energetic. And if we want, we can subtract out a background of stuff that's the same for the two species, or I keep saying the mu's, but it's the x's, and just leave something with, well, I didn't subtract off correctly, because there should be some mixture in this 45 degree things, there should be some mixture of the two colors. So that wasn't too well done. But anyway, I've got an angular distribution, and it looks like more X's going up and more E's going down. The final graph that I'll show you will be the result of doing a simulation of those equations, taking 14 different beams. I mean, you know, especially as spherical harmonics is not so wonderful in the nonlinear problem, and I believe it's more efficient, and other people seem to find it more efficient to just consolidate these areas of solid angle into a bunch of beams and then do enough so you think you're converging. And so my 14 is one up and one down, and 45 degrees, a bunch in the plane, and you know, with a steady change in the initial conditions as we work our way downwards. But to explain the innards of this, I can take two beams. So take my word for it that I can do. Did I say 24? 14. 14 beams is already 56 equations of the kind that I was writing down there, when you think about it. 56 independent equations. It's a spin system now, right? It's that something can be an X or an E, and I'm going to do more spin, individual spin raising, lowering, and third component operators here for the up-moving space, call them sigma. For the down-moving space, call them tau. Collective coordinates, just summing over these sigmas, calling it S. Summing over the taus, calling it T. Rewriting my Hamiltonian, which looks pretty trivial. It just is the collective guys. Notice that in this Hamiltonian, S doesn't interact with S. There's no nonlinear term with something going this way and something going that way. And it's something going the same way. That's because of the 1 minus cosine theta in the interaction. Or if you like, it's because two neutrinos co-moving have, moving at a small angle, have very low energy in their center of mass system. And I put a parameter in here. The parameter that came from what I had before is 1, unity for neutrinos. Now, what is this photons? I'm going to do a slight diversion on photons, because I think this is kind of amusing. It might shed some light, and does shed some light on something sooner or later. If we go back to this is probably the ancestor of all effective field theories, isn't it? It's the photon-photon interaction with the low energies with the electron loop integrated out. And here we have polarizations instead of flavors. And, that's what it is. Now, I have to come to Kotkin and Serbo for a minute, in a moment. This is not their laser down here. This is laser from some experimentalist at SLAC who did the following experiment. They took this optical laser beam, and they hit it with, they hit some of it way out here with a high energy electron beam coming in the multi-GeVs. And so energetic photons came back, I think, in the GeV region. See, I've got two things pointed here, the Kotkin and the servo, and the experiment they actually did. So a few GeV. And then in order to get energy conservation for producing electron-positron pair, I mean, they had coherent light here, so you could do some four-photon absorption. And they made electron-positron pairs. And so it was a very cute experiment, and they tried to make a big deal out of it, saying they had done scouting of light by light. I didn't actually like that, because it's a second-order process, and I always thought this was the scattering of light by light. But it didn't matter, of course. It was a nice experiment. So having said that, I'll come back to Kotkin and Serbo, who asked a different question. And we're looking at this interaction here. They said, and not electron-positrons, they said, suppose we take the same apparatus and we send in a beam with linear polarization, and you're, is it really a connection problem?
Click on the X.
On which?
On this X on the upper right corner.
I think you just hit return.
And switch off the wireless.
So just leave it. Yeah,
just well, I can't, but my laser, oh, that's right. That's all right. My laser's under there now, but something important will be under there after a while. They considered both beams, both the beam and the laser, linearly polarized at an angle which wasn't 90 or 180 degrees. And they calculated classically, taking this, putting this into a classical action, this Heisenberg-Euler thing up here. And another thing is failing me now. They calculate classically what would happen to the polarizations, and here's what they found. They found that the polarizations would exchange. One polarization would rotate around the other at a characteristic distance with the parameters that I had over there in 3 centimeters from the photon-photon interaction. The scattering of the photon from the cross-section itself, given the laser beam density, if you wanted to get an appreciable probability for scattering, you'd go 10 to the 9 centimeters. So if that isn't the speed up, what is? That was a sort of a marvelous thing. Unfortunately, since the Kotkin and Serbo off at the Novosibirsk actually thought that this could be done at SLAC and been pushing on them to do it, but once SLAC had confirmed photon-photon scattering, they wanted to move on to better things. So I've also asked the question about colliding photon clouds. We had colliding neutrino clouds, so to speak, because I had a set of arrows this way for one kind of neutrino and this way for the other kind of neutrino, and did a calculation of the polarization loss, and I find the polarization, the cloud loses polarization in a distance of about Kotkin and Serbo's distance times logarithm of n. N is the number of particles in the box. But a logarithm is never big. So without worrying about what that means, too much. I mean, n, presumably, if there were any reality to this, you know, this should be inscrutable, because I'm going to come back and tell you how it works with neutrinos. But if there were any reality in it, then the n would have to be a box that was as big as some coherence length cubed. Physics there or not there, I don't know. But I thought it was pretty amusing. Okay, back to the equations. the instabilities I'm going to discuss. Oh, and that log n ties into instabilities. So here I am with my parameterized neutrinos and photons here, and say there's an equation for the flavor-conserving part of the density matrix here, the diagonal elements, and one for the off-diagonal elements here. If we start with initial states that are purely diagonal, then nothing happens. This guy is zero twice over on the right, and this guy over here has a T plus and a T minus. So you don't get something from nothing. Something has to start moving. But on the other hand, we can put in these values. And now I've taken a discrete number, n of these in a box, n of these guys going up, n of them going down. Over here, initial condition. We can put that in for the T3s here. And then I have a linearized equation around this solution, trivial solution, the nonlinear one, and I can look for growing modes. And it's not too hard. I mean, it's a quadratic, you know, it's just a two by two matrix, and about to become a 28 by 28 matrix when I do my simulation that I care about more. And here are the eigenvalues and the growth rate, and zeta equals 1 was my neutrino case. And so that's kind of dead because there's no growing mode. Photon case, zeta equals 0. I get a mixing time scale, which is my fast rate. G is a generic coupling constant by now, you understand. It's whatever it would be for photons. A fast rate, which means that if we started with an original tilt of some kind, there's something wrong with my fingers, or I could do this. If we started with an original tilt, or for photons, a slight polarization mixture of helicity states one way, helicity states the other way, elliptical polarization, or maybe a birefringent medium, the thing would go like crazy, because this is a very fast time if we started with something. The neutrino problem, we have to do a little bit more, but the fact that there was a zero eigenvalue turns out to mean that if in the same instability equations we put in some neutrino mass matrix of the kind that's called inverted hierarchy, then there is again a growing mode. But here, instead of being given something that is there and that will get amplified very rapidly with this growth rate, we're given something that has to develop in time in order to stimulate the instability that makes it go faster. And that's where we get the geometric mean of the two rates, which I call the medium fast rate. Beyond the mean field, I just said that in the mean field, if there's no oscillation term or initial tilt, the mean field equations say that nothing's happened. We can just do perturbation theory to see, to find a flavor mixing time, and it's this isn't beyond the mean field. This is just, well, it is. It's taking the equation that without putting those brackets in, which means something can happen, and calculate the rate at which things get mixed. And instead of going like 1 over gn, it goes as 1 over g squared of n. I don't want to do the arithmetic for this, but what that means is that nothing would be happening until you get way out where you have scattering effects anyway, in which case it's not correct to have omitted the non-forward parts of the interaction. Or we can just solve the system because it's such a simple Hamiltonian, you can just put it on your computer and solve it. The two cases are beyond the mean field that have nice solutions. The first case is the neutrinos where zeta equals 1 and it's stable, ostensibly stable. This is with two beams. And, well, Friedman and Lunardini didn't exactly do the problem I posed here with the two beams, but they did a problem which can be solved in exactly the same way. It comes out to be some sum of Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. You can take the asymptotic forms and get the high number of particles behavior. And so they find this growth rate, which is perturbative in a sense. So it doesn't do much for you as far as phenomena is concerned. In the photon case, you cannot use their tricks. You have to solve a real equation.
Before you go on,
yeah.
How did you really go beyond mean field? Now you say you estimated.
I had a Hamiltonian, okay, and it had. I'm going to take 500 neutrinos going up and 500 neutrinos going down, and I'm going to solve it. I'm going to solve it. Well, and it isn't. See, you might think that's 2 to the 500th elements in the wave function, but the thing is so symmetric, it's only 500. The states are all symmetric as you move ups to downs, and so it's, if you want to do 500, it's maybe it's 1,000 simultaneous nonlinear equations, and you can just put them on your laptop, which is all I've got, and solve them. Oops. Yeah, I say I've done that, and there's the logarithm there. And therefore, something which is speeded up at any finite n, whether that means something for physics depends a little bit on how you interpret that that end. But let me go on, because it might have been good if I just said this is a spin system to begin with. That's a row of spin ups and a row of spin downs initially, and the interaction that I like just this interaction which switches an up with a down, but doesn't interact between these guys. I mean, it doesn't interact between these guys even when they're pointing in different directions. So it's an XY model and not the Ising type of interaction. And how long does it take for a set of things like this to go into a set of things like this? Well, this is a nice example which comes very close to a limit established by one of the heroes of, what kind of physics is that called? Seth Lloyd, one of the heroes of quantum information sorts of physics, who set a time limit on how fast a system can, rigorous time limit on how fast a system can evolve into an orthogonal system, where the constraint is the energy reserves of the system, which is quantified with various expectations of Hamiltonian squared and stuff like that. And in spite of the fact that we're not just going into an orthogonal state, we're changing every spin into the opposite spin, this comes within that logarithm of fulfilling the bound that Lloyd and his Italian sidekicks were so proud of. So I always thought it was a nice example.
So you say this system has an instability?
This what?
This spin system has an instability?
Yes. Oh, this is exactly the same system. So this goes back to that quadratic square root of 1 minus, and I've taken that parameter, lambda. That's what gave me the XY model rather than the Ising model. The neutrinos is the Ising form of the interaction, and you have to do more. So I had the solution. It was looking for a problem, okay? Still is. well, here's the result of a typical calculation from going from n equals 8 to n equals 5, 12, where the r, that's just a flip from 1 to minus 1, and you can see the equal space, I've doubled each time from between 8 and 5, 12, doubled the number n, and you can see the logarithm quite explicitly there. Now my next statement is, assuming for the moment that there could be something interesting under in that calculation I just did, which is to once again say what it is. I took the case where the eigenvalue in mean field was complex, and then I looked for that situation at beyond the mean field, and I found this logarithmic very fast correction for any finite n, which formally goes to zero for infinite n. That can be treated analytically if you want to do the following things. Instead of just taking the operator, the two raising operators for up and down, and the two third component measuring spin operators. I mean, you don't need a lowering. Once you take mean field, you don't need a lowering operator. That's just the complex conjugate of the raising one. And we took the commutators to get the equations of the motion. That defined the mean field equation. If we just take a more complicated set of operators, some of which are quadratic, and this R's and S's, which are already quadratic, and you take the commutator with the Hamiltonian, then you get, and then you fairly non-arbitrarily sneak in brackets there. You get a product of two things, and you make it into the, you get the expectation of a product, you make it into the product of expectation. Then we get a bunch of coupled equations for these other guys here. And again, there are boundary conditions. Easy to set. If I scale the time and the density, then in the equation I'm most interested about, which is R is in effect the mu minus tau discrepancy going up, and S is the mu minus tau discrepancy going down. So they start out at opposite signs. And so W is the thing that I want to let evolve. If I scale that down with the number of particles, and I scale the time to the fast time, then there's a rather simple equation for the thing I want, which may be pretty familiar, because if you take away this correction term, like 1 over n, that's the equation for the 5/4 kink. And the boundary conditions are now under the damn connection problem. Is that God telling me something? How do you say I'm supposed to cure that?
Just click on the X.
You click on the X.
On what?
Leave it, it will disappear.
There it is.
Well, all I have to do is shake my fist. Yeah, the boundary conditions are what you expect. Vanishing function, vanishing derivative. And so, you can even see from this equation that if n is infinity, it's going to take forever for this thing to happen, because that the solution is the tanh kink. So that's starting way out at infinity on the tanh, and it doesn't go anywhere. Also pretty easy to see on that same kind of argumentation how this gets turned into a logarithm. You can trade this for a slightly different initial condition that puts you not that far out on the curve. And here's how it works as compared to the real solution. I plotted the solutions to the nonlinear equation from 8 to 8192, going up by factors of 4. And the dotted lines are the actual solution of the model, which only went up to 512, as you saw. And, well, it's not it's not perfect, but bearing in fact that the original mean field problem gave nothing happening, this is actually pretty good at simulating what happened. It's kind of fun. When I say how you could use this, that's going to be probably pretty speculative. Okay. Nobody wants to see, well, I tried very hard to make a picture with 14 arrows in perspective going off into space. I mean, you know, just using arrows in PowerPoint or something. I failed so completely at that I'm saying there are 14 beams. Up to down to intermediate, and I put on a steady change as you go down in polar angle towards more electrons and fewer X's. And I also put on a random 10% variation. I did that over and over again. I found 50% of the time, I found for the parameter range in question, well, more than 50% of the time, I found the fast growth, the very fast growth form of the eigenvalue. That's to say, I just took the neutral current and linearized it with these 14 beams, having perturbed these initial conditions so that there's some azimuthal, I think it's the azimuth that matters, such as some azimuthal irregularities. And lo and behold, there is not only a complex root in the linear perturbation theory, but the whole flavor turns over and then mixes and oscillates in consequence. And the time scale out here is the very fast time scale. So we're down to around a second here under field conditions. And this has nothing to do with my law again stuff, because here, instead of waiting for something to happen, you understand that that exercise I just did, which I'm very proud of, but might have just confused the hell out of everybody for no reason. I started with no prior mixing or rotation or mechanism to cause it to come about. These simulations are with the neutrino mixing parameters from solar neutrinos. So this is supposed to be back to real physics. And the this is, you know, the order of a second, the order of a centimeter, rather, within the star. So it could turn over rather rapidly. What happens in the 50% of the time that I don't get a complex root there? Well, then it starts getting infinitely complex, because in the case of the so-called inverted hierarchy, I get a lot of mixing, but for the case of the normal hierarchy, it's practically nil. And that accords with the results that Raphael and his group have gotten in the last couple of years. It mattered a lot to them whether the hierarchy was normal or inverted. My conjecture is, if they didn't have the cylindrical symmetry that they have in their problem, I can't really describe their problem. But maybe they get the some hint of this coming in. Anyway, that's my physics result. And now,
you say there's almost no difference between normal hierarchy and inverted hierarchy.
Well, if I get what I call my very rapid rate, if I get a complex eigenvalue in the linearized problem under the conditions that there's no neutrino mixing put in there at all, then of course that's true whether the mass difference is one sign or the other, which is the key to this. But it works out that way in the big simulation. Here I solve the equations, you understand. And my moral under here is that I've done this quite a few times, and you know, I easy enough for numerically competent people, which I'm not one, to solve 56 couple nonlinear equations over thousands of oscillation times. But on the other hand, if you were putting that into a code in a supernova where there's all kinds of other stuff going on, then forget it, right? So it's kind of nice to have the fact that just empirically, we get this complete mixing whenever this simple 28 by 28 matrix that characterizes the initial condition has an imaginary eigenvalue, has a complex eigenvalue. Well, it's some progress toward phenomenal energy, maybe. Even though, did I say this already? Yeah, I've gotten kind of bored with that application. And therefore, maybe, are there other systems besides supernova where this stuff could matter? Well, I don't know. You know, there are still people talking about sterile neutrinos for cold dark matter, and as time goes on, they have to be heavier and heavier. I think they're up to 10 keV or something now, a minimum mass, just to avoid constraints from astrophysics. And then if you make them that heavy, and you try to produce them just by mixing in from ordinary neutrinos, you have to use such a big coupling that their radiative decays will kill you, give you an X-ray background out there. But naturally, goes without saying, you don't need to hear this from anybody. There are ways of avoiding that if you want to make theories with, what does it say here? Oh, yeah, neutrino chemical potentials coming down from wherever in the past. And George Fuller has written papers on that, and so have other people. So they're dynamical accelerants that will accelerate the mixing the amount that you want, but won't increase the sterile neutrino decay into an ordinary neutrino plus a gamma ray, which you don't want. My guess is that the neutral current effects, that if you were doing this, you would have to go back and take all the stuff that I've been doing seriously. Of course, I'm totally agnostic about whether that's a good form of dark matter or not. I just would say that it's not in the ascendancy, since all the attention is on what might come out of the LHC at the moment. But it'll probably hang around, and people will probably write papers about it. Second is, if, as some people have conjectured and used for, you know, supernova-related limit stuff, a neutrino and a neutrino, a Majorana neutrino and Majorana neutrino and neutrino can go into two very light scalar particles. Of whatever kind, then the kind of mechanism I talked about, I believe, even though a neutrino can't spin a half particle can't mix with a scalar particle, it's a kind of pair mixing that describes that much of what I've been talking about, and I believe that there could be wholesale conversion just after conventional neutrino decoupling, bringing me to conclusions. Well, I guess I remember writing conclusions down, and I kept changing my mind about what they should be. Give me another second to recall some of it, and say something I just thought of almost as I was standing here when I came into the room. Well, and again, to some extent, it was stimulated by Jürgen's question to George. One thing I didn't investigate, you know, I have these, I have this, two things, and other people have them too. I kept saying I have them, but I mean, this is what people do that work in this problem, which is the totally forward assumption for the dynamics. And then there's the mean field. And I found that when the mean field was unstable, then you had to look more carefully at the mean field itself. But I found, well, maybe it didn't matter because that effect might appear to go away as the box becomes infinite, but only logarithmically. But you could well ask, when the mean field becomes unstable, do the other modes come back at in an important earlier way? And that's something I just haven't considered, which is worth somebody's doing to see how the instability in the mean field maybe can interlock with the part of the theory you thought you could set aside and use only for later times. So now I'll move on to conclusions. There's still none. Thanks.
So maybe just when you study physics of parametric resonance or spin over decomposition, and then you may also ask, when does the mean field become of importance? And when you hire, say, in a diagrammatic language, would be two loop contributions become important, is you do find that, yes, as you said, that at an earlier time, the two loop contributions becomes of importance, which is triggered by an instability. So this can happen. I'm not sure about this system you're studying.
Could I say one more thing which might be of general interest to really quickly? And that is that I found in a very circuitous fashion and without totally understanding what I was doing, when I went back to Kotkin and Serbo, who did this classical calculation of from the photon-photon interaction and of the change in the spin, it occurs to me that a lot of what you could do within the totally forward and mean field picture is totally classical. These density matrices can be classical fields as far as that goes. And there is another way of calculating it, I guess, where you don't break into AA daggers and stuff like that. You can comment on that later. I won't make you.
No, but if you have fermions.
No, but it's the bilinears that are the coordinates.
No, but how do you do it with fermions? You cannot do a simulation with fermions without taking into account the statistics. With bosons, you can do it.
Everything I did simulations, and there were fermions. And believe me, it would have been the same with fermions and bosons. In the mean field.
Yes, in the mean field approximation, okay. That's true, but if you want to go beyond, so you said it's a classical system. On the mean field level, everything is classical. That's true. But once you go beyond...
Yeah, you probably will. Yeah. No, yeah, I take your point, yeah.
Going to come back to the actual impact of this on understanding supernova. That's still murky.
There's so many other issues, Larry. Oh, well, yeah. No. I'm not going to go on forever making private speeches, but yes, I know what's to be done by now, and that is by me, and that is I have to send this letter to Adam Burrows that I've been writing in my mind. Because he told me when he was here for 5 minutes the I mean, when I got to talk to them for 5 minutes during the advisory board meeting, that they had much better angular distributions in spectra now, neutrino angular distributions in, throughout the star. And so the first idea was, yeah, go and get a parameterization of these guys, put them in and see if it's in the region that I would call unstable. But a better idea would first be to bang the table and say, listen, does it matter for your simulations, the dynamical simulations, if every time you make a neutrino in there, you change your code so it just makes it an incoherent mixture? And does that make any difference? That's what I'd like to know first. And I don't think they've done that. All right.